experiences they fully realize. But the reality of any finite experience lies just in this fact, that the living God is in it and expresses some divine purpose through it, so that a man may, as George Fox's friend Isaac Pennington says, become an organ of the life and power of God, and propagate God's life in the world. The mystic of this type may feel the light break within him, and know that God is there, or he may equally well discover him as he performs some clear, plain duty which lies across his path. His whole mystical insight is in his discovery that God is near, and not beyond the reach of the ladders which he has given us. No one has found the true George Fox when he stops with an analysis of the views which he held. Almost more remarkable than the truth which he proclaimed was the fervor, the enthusiasm, the glowing passion of the man. He was of the genuine apostolic type. He had come through years of despair over the wickedness of the world. But as soon as the light really broke and he knew that he had a message for the world in its sin and ignorance, there was after that nothing but the grave itself which could keep him quiet. He preached in cathedrals, on haystacks, on cliffs of rock, from hilltops, under apple trees and elm trees, in barns and in city squares, while he sent epistles from every prison in which he was shut up. Wherever he could find men who had souls to save, he told them of the life and truth which he had found. Whether one is in sympathy with Fox's mystical view of life or not, it is impossible not to be impressed with the practical way in which he wrought out his faith. After all, the view that God and man are not isolated was not new. The really new thing was the appearance of a man who genuinely practiced the divine presence and lived as though he knew that his life was in a divine environment. We have dwelt upon the fundamental religious principle of Fox at some length, because his great work as a social reformer and as the organizer of a new system of church government proceeds from this root principle. One central idea moves through all he did. His originality lies, however, not so much in the discovery or the rediscovery of the principle as in the fearless application of it. Other men had believed in divine guidance. Other Christians had proclaimed the impenetration of God in the lives of men. But George Fox had the courage to carry his conviction to its logical conclusions. He knew that there were difficulties entailed in calling men everywhere to trust the light and to follow the voice, but he believed that there were more serious difficulties to be faced by those who put some external authority in the place of the soul's own sight. He was ready for the consequences, and he proceeded to carry out both in the social and in the religious life of his time the experiment of obeying the light within. It is this courageous fidelity to his insight that made him a social reformer and a religious organizer. He belongs in this respect in the same list with St. Francis of Assisi. They both attempted the difficult task of bringing religion from heaven to earth. 1. In the light of his religious discovery, Fox reinterpreted man as a member of society. If man has direct intercourse with God, he is to be treated with noble respect. He met the doctrine of the divine right of kings with the conviction of the divine right of man. Every man is to be treated as a man. He was a leveler, but he leveled up, not down. Every man was to be read in terms of his possibilities. If not of royal descent, certainly of royal destiny. This view made Fox an unparalleled optimist. He believed that a mighty transformation would come as soon as men were made aware of this divine relationship which he had discovered. They would go to living as he had done in the power of his conviction. He began at once to put in practice his principle of equality, i.e., equality of privilege. He cut straight through the elaborate web of social custom which hid man's true nature from himself. Human life had become sicklied, or with a cast of sham, until man had half forgotten to act as man. Fox rejected for himself every social custom which seemed to him to be hollow and to belittle man himself. The honor which belonged to God he would give to no man, and the honor which belonged to any man he gave to every man. This was the reason for his thee and thou. The plural form had been introduced to give distinction. He would not use it. The Lord Protector and the humble Cotter were addressed alike. He had an eye for the person of great gifts, and he never wished to reduce men to indistinguishable atoms of society. But he was resolved to guard the jewel of personality in every individual, man or woman. Two, his estimate of the worth of man made him a reformer. In society, as he found it, men were often treated more as things than as persons. For petty offenses, they were hung. And if they escaped this fate, they were put into prisons where no touch of man's humanity was in evidence. Footnote 3, after hung. At this epoch, there were more than 200 capital offenses. In the never-ending wars, the common people were hardly more than human dice. Their worth as men was well nigh forgotten. Trade was conducted on a system of sliding prices. High for this man, low for some others. Dealers were honest where they had to be, dishonest where they could be. The courts of justice were extremely uncertain and irregular, as the pages of this journal continually show. Against every such crooked system which failed to recognize the divine right of man, George Fox set himself. He himself had large opportunities of observing the courts of justice and the inhuman pens which by courtesy were called jails. But he became a reformer, not to secure his own rights or to get a better jail to lie in, but to establish the principle of human rights for all men. He went calmly to work to carry an out-and-out honesty into all trade relations, to establish a fixed price for goods of every sort, to make principles of business square with principles of religion. By voice or by epistle, he called every judge in the realm to mind that of God within him. He refused ever to take an oath, because he was resolved to make a plain man's yea weigh as heavy as an oath. He was always in the lists against the barbarity of the penal system, the inequity of enslaving men, the wickedness of war, the wastefulness of fashion, and the evils of drunkenness, and by argument and deed he undertook to lead the way to a new heroism, better than the heroism of battlefields. 3. The logic of his principle compelled him to value education. If all men are to count as men, it is a man's primary duty to be all he can be. To be a poor organ of God when one was meant for a good one belongs among the high sins. Footnote 4. Dear friends and brethren that have gone into America and the islands thereaway, stir up the gift of God in you and improve your talents. Let your light shine among the Indians, the blacks, and the whites, that ye may answer the truth in them, and bring them to the standard and ensign that God hath set up, Jesus Christ. Grow in the faith and grace of Christ, that ye be not like the dwarfs, for a dwarf shall not come near to offer upon God's altar. From an epistle, George Fox, written in 1690. If it was open to him that Oxford and Cambridge could not make men ministers, his own reason taught him that it is not safe to call all men to obey the voice and follow the light without broad-basing them at the same time in the established facts of history and nature. Fox himself very early set up schools for boys and girls alike in which everything civil and useful in creation was to be taught. It is, however, quite possible that he undervalued the aesthetic side of man and that he suffered by his attempt to starve it. In this particular, he shared the Puritan tendency, and had not learned how to hold all things in proportion, and to make the culture of the senses at the same time beautify the inner man. 4. On the distinctive religious side, his discovery of a direct divine human relationship led to a new interpretation of worship and ministry. God is not far off. He needs no vicar, no person of any sort between himself and the worshiper. Grace no more needs a special channel than the dew does. There is no special holy place, as though God were more there than here. He does not come from somewhere else. He is spirit, needs only a responsive soul, an open heart, to be found. Worship properly begins when the soul discovers him and enjoys his presence. In the simplest words, it is the soul's appreciation of God. With his usual optimism, he believed that all men and women were capable of this stupendous attainment. He threw away all crutches at the start and called upon everybody to walk in the Spirit, to live in the light. His house of worship was bare of everything but seats. It had no shrine, for the Shekinah was to be in the hearts of those who worshiped. It had no altar, for God needed no appeasing, seeing that he himself had made the sacrifice for sin. It had no baptismal font, for baptism was, in his belief, nothing short of immersion into the life of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Going down into the significance of Christ's death and coming up in newness of life with him. There was no communion table because he believed that the true communion consisted in partaking directly of the soul's spiritual bread, the living Christ. There were no confessionals, for in the silence, with the noise and din of the outer life hushed, the soul was to unveil itself to its Maker and let his light lay bare its true condition. There was no organ or choir, for each forgiven soul was to give praise in the glad notes that were natural to it. No censer was swung, for he believed God wanted only the fragrance of sincere and prayerful spirits. There was no priestly mitre, because each member of the true church was to be a priest unto God. No official robes were in evidence, because the entire business of life, in meeting and outside, was to be the putting on of the white garments of a saintly life. From beginning to end, worship was the immediate appreciation of God and the appropriate activity of the whole being in response to him. William Penn says of him, "The most awful, living, reverent frame I ever felt or beheld was his in prayer, and this was because he realized that he was in the presence of God when he prayed." He believed that the ministry of truth is limited to no class of men and to no sex. As fast and as far as any man discovers God, it becomes his business to make him known to others. His ability to do this effectively is a gift from God and makes him a minister. The only thing the church does is to recognize the gift. This idea carried with it perfect freedom of utterance to all who felt a call to speak, a principle which has worked out better than the reader would guess, though it has been often sorely tested. In the society which he founded, there was no distinction of clergy and laity. He undertook the difficult task of organizing a Christian body in which the priesthood of believers should be an actual fact, and in which the ordinary religious exercises of the church should be under the directing and controlling power of the Holy Spirit, manifesting itself through the congregation. Not the least service of Fox to his age was the important part which he took in breaking down the intolerable doctrine of predestination, which hung like an incubus over men's lives. It threw a gloom upon every person who found himself forced by his logic to believe it, and its effect upon sensitive souls was simply dreadful. Fox met this doctrine with argument, but he met it also with something better than argument. He set over against it two facts: that divine grace and light are free, and that an inward certainty of God's favor and acceptance is possible for every believer. Wherever Quakerism went, this inward assurance went with it. The shadow of dread, uncertainty, gave place to sunlight and joy. This was the beginning of a spiritual emancipation which is still growing, and peaceful faces and fragrant lives are the result. No reader of the journal can fail to be impressed with the fact that George Fox believed himself to be an instrument for the manifestation of miraculous power. Diseases were cured through him. He foretold coming events. He often penetrated states and conditions of mind and heart. He occasionally had a sense of what was happening in distant parts, and he himself underwent, on at least three occasions, striking bodily changes, so that he seemed, for days at a time, like one dead, and was in one of these times incapable of being bled. These passages need trouble no one, nor need their truthfulness be questioned. He possessed an unusual psychical nature, delicately organized, capable of experiences of a novel sort, but such as are today very familiar to the student of psychical phenomena. The marvel is that with such a mental organization, he was so sane and practical, and so steadily kept his balance throughout a life which furnished numerous chances for shipwreck. It is very noticeable, rather more so in the complete journal than in this autobiography, that judgments came upon almost everybody who was a malicious opposer of him or his work. God cut him off soon after, is a not infrequent phrase. It is manifestly impossible to investigate these cases now and to verify the facts. But the well-tested honesty of the early friends leaves little ground for doubting that the facts were substantially as they are reported. Fox's own inference that all these persons had misfortune as a direct judgment for having harmed him and hindered his cause will naturally seem to us a too hasty conclusion. It is not at all strange that in this eventful period, many persons who had dealings with him should have suffered swift changes of fortune. And of course, he failed to note how many there were who did not receive judgment in this direct manner. One regrets, of course, that this kindly spiritual man should have come so near enjoying what seemed to him a divine vengeance upon his enemies. But we must remember that he believed in his soul that his work was God's work, and hence to frustrate it was serious business. He founded a society, as he called it, which he evidently hoped and probably believed would sometime become universal. Footnote 5. In 1658, there was not a Quaker living who did not believe Quakerism to be the one only true church of the living God. From Hancock's Peculium, page 8. The organization in every aspect recognized the fundamentally spiritual nature of man. Every individual was to be a vital organic part of the whole, free but possessed of a freedom which had always to be exercised with a view to the interest and edification of the whole. It was modeled exactly on the conception of Paul's universal church of many members, made a unity not from without, but by the living presence of the one Spirit. All this work of organization was effected while Fox himself was in the saddle, carrying his message to town after town, interrupted by long absences in jail and dungeon, and steadily opposed by the fanatical antinomian elements which had flocked to his standard. It is not the least mark of his genius that in the face of an almost unparalleled persecution, he left his 50,000 followers in Great Britain and Ireland, formed into a working and growing body, with equally well-organized meetings in Holland, New England, New York, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, and the Carolinas. His personality and his message had won men from every station of life. And if the rank and file were from the humbler walks, there were also men and women of scholarship and fame. Robert Barclay, from the School of Paris, gave the new faith its permanent expression in his apology. William Penn worked